Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, welcome to the final episode of Rahulastapa, this series with Mark Steele. There'll be a couple of specials coming up at least between now and September, but there's going to be a little bit of a quiet time, and those will be audio only from the MacArthur Festival and from the Wells Comedy Festival. So hope you will enjoy those little extras coming out. But Series 14 starts on September 24th when we're recording. Got very exciting guests from America for that first one. And hopefully lots of other exciting people coming up. So go to leicestersquaretheatre.com, buy tickets in advance so you don't miss out when the names are announced. If you become a Dripster or a Badger, of course, you get the names of the guests before everyone else. d.rip/Richard-Herring or gofasterstrike.com/badges, as well as helping us to pay for the series, and you also get backstage interviews and enter into competition and lots of other little benefits as well. If you're a Dripster, you get one of my stand-up shows every 2 months for free. Well, you know, on top of what you paid. Anyway, thanks to everyone who came to this last series and contributed to make it a success. We do need to raise some money for the next series because the yearly amount of money from Badgers and Dripsters isn't going to quite cover it, but we have covered that first series via all you lovely lot. So thanks for that. And remember my emergency questions book, the new one with 1,001 questions, 700 of which have not appeared in print before, will be out in October. So by that, the money from that will go to me for once. That's right. Anyway, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this excellent podcast with the very clever and lovely Mark Steele.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. It's the last show of the series. Everyone's boarding games. Please welcome a man. Please welcome a man who is shooting blue sperm over George the Sandman as we speak. It's Richard Herring. Yo, yo! Hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to some fans of As It Occurs to Me, the 2000 and 11 podcasts the other day. They call it Rehalastapa, so I don't know if that's, going to catch on. It's the last one of the series. We're waiting to find out if we've been recommissioned, so fingers crossed. I was at King's Cross. I come down from King's Cross because I live in Hertfordshire now, and came on the train. And when you get there, there's loads of people standing outside the Harry Potter shop. You've seen this in King's Cross, because there's a wall and it says platform 9 3/4 on it. And people then queue up to have their photo taken by that for ages. Like, there's a massive, it's like you think, oh God, what's going on? There's a crowd, there's a massive crowd of people. I was just thinking, if there's ever a terrorist attack on King's Cross, that's going to be the last thing loads of people do. Imagine that, getting to heaven, go, what were you doing when you died? Oh, I was having my photo taken outside an imaginary platform that doesn't exist. It was worth it, wasn't it, mate? Well done. Don't like jokes about terrorism here in London, but everywhere else in the country, they're fucking laughing their asses off. That's the good thing about living in the country. Wait, you'll see Richard Herring. I was watching Beat Bugs. Anyone fan of Beat Bugs in? No, I'd never seen it either. It's on Netflix. My daughter wanted to watch it, and it's like anthropomorphized insects. Can never say that word, insects. And it sort of opens, and they all sing "All You Need Is Love" by the Beatles. You go, fucking hell, how did they afford to get the rights to this? Then the whole show is insects singing songs by the Beatles. I can't think, what John Lennon think about this? If he was alive, he would live to see this travesty. But you're not in control, are you? It's like Charles Dickens with the Muppet Christmas Carol. What would he think of that if he came, once he'd got over the technological aspect of there being puppets, first of all, and then film puppets? I think Charles Dickens would hate the Muppets Christmas Carol, but I think he would. It's better than the Christmas Carol. No, it's weird. It's kind of weird to think that you're not in control. It's just an interesting thing. It's not a comedy routine. It's interesting to think that your artistic legacy, like this podcast is similar to the Beatles, might be appropriated in 50, 60 years' time by someone else. Would you be happy? Would you think? I mean, the Beatles did a cartoon, didn't they? Remember that? David, remember the Beatles cartoon? No! Anyone remember the Beatles cartoon? Yeah, there was one. Thank you. It was better than that shit. A load of shit. Sellout shit. But there we go. It's just interesting. Anyway, so let's crack on. I'm as interested in the artistic vision. You're not as interested in it as I am, because you're not artistic like I am. It's got like Sia in it and Regina Spektor. They must have spent a lot of money on this show for like little kids. It's fucking shit. I'd be few. What I'm saying is, John, if I was John Lennon, I'd be glad that I was shot in the head. That's what I'm saying. And I didn't have to see that. There we go. I knew there was something in there somewhere. So it's all right to laugh about John Lennon being assassinated, but when it's you might be killed by ISIS, suddenly you shut up, don't you? Hypocrites. I hope ISIS kills all of you tonight. So this is when the series turned. It was going so well for Richard Herring until he basically supported a terrorist networks. I can understand why they would. That's all I'm saying. So anyway, that's the kind of thing that Ben Walker would be worried about, Dave, if he was producing, but Dave's made a song of stuff. I'll go through. What I'm saying, ISIS, if you're listening at home, come and have a fucking go if you think you're hard enough. To get hard. If you think you can kill our audience, you've got another thing. Come and try, is what I'm saying. Edit that bit, I take it. But I'll probably be okay up here. So anyway, our guest this week is probably best known as Ski Man from the Time Slides episode of Red Dwarf. Yeah, many of people remembering that. And also, he is the only semi-professional Andrew Collins lookalike working in the working in the country today. Will you please welcome Mark Steele, ladies and gentlemen?
Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Mark Steele.
Thank you. That's always good warm-up practice to get ISIS in.
There's not enough ISIS jokes on mainstream television. They should start the news with it, shouldn't they? Well, lots of things have happened in the economy, but first of all, here's an ISIS joke.
Yeah. People say you joke about Jesus and Easter, but would you joke about ISIS? Yes, I would, but my producer will edit it out, so this isn't helpful.
Do you think they sort of, when they're looking for targets, they'll be somewhere in what's left of their caliphate? Look, this fucker, what he say about us?
I'm very helpful.
That's how they choose them.
I've given quite a lot of good terrorist atrocity ideas in this podcast over the years. Yeah. So they actually quite like me.
They owe you a few, Bob, don't they? Just, I was painted that one.
So they haven't used a couple of them. So it's... They haven't done the... What came up with a good one was Barocca. You can have explosives in a Barocca that you just put in water on a plane and then shake it up and bang. That would work, wouldn't it? That's a good one. And breast implants, explosives. They haven't done that one yet.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Now, I've got loads of good ideas. If anyone from ISIS is listening wants to... Seriously, sorry about the stuff earlier. That was just a joke. But if you want to... Don't kill me, because I've got some good ideas.
That would at least be imaginative on their part, wouldn't it? That would at least be imaginative on their part.
Yeah,
if they use breast implants, people would be going, well, it's terrible. But on the other end, you know, you've got... credit where it's due.
Yeah. You'd spot the blokes coming, though, wouldn't you? Do you get mistaken for the broadcaster Andrew Collins very much?
All the time. All the bloody time. Yeah, even my own family. Andrew, where's Dad, they say.
And do you remember... it's nice. It feels like we've done a lot of podcasts together already, Mark. I feel very relaxed. Yeah. Do you remember being in that Red Dwarf?
Well, vaguely. This was about 30 years ago. Yeah. I can't remember why I got asked to go on it. And it was... I was on it for I don't know what I did, even. I think I had to dress up in a skiing thing.
Yeah.
And then... I don't know. That was it. And then they sort of took a picture of me or something. And then that was...
Anyone know?
Surely not. Even the
there
most...
There must be some
freaky...
Red Dwarf fans in who know every single thing.
It's an episode where...
No.
I have been waiting for my moment. It's an episode where...
They can go inside photographs.
They can go inside photographs.
Oh, no. Please.
And Andrew... sorry, again, Mark...
They did think it was Andrew. And I'd got there and they went, oh, fuck, you got the wrong one. Well, I tell you who I get mistaken for is Mark Thomas. I get mistaken for all the time. And to this extent, right, this was the finest example of being mistaken for Mark Thomas. The Radio Times one week, honestly, it said, had my radio show advertised, and it said, 6:30, Mark Steele's in town, weekly show in which comedian Mark Thomas tours the town. It honestly said that.
And there's something about Mark's. I once had to introduce Mark. Now I've said all these Marks, I can't think of his name, and he's my friend, the Bristol comedian, Mark Watson.
Right.
And it was in Bristol, and everyone had come to see him. And as I was introducing him, I was about to say Mark Thomas, and then I had to think within, and my brain went... as I was saying, please welcome to the stage, Mark. And it did come out as Watson, but it took. But my brain was very confused.
Isn't it?
Yeah, so it must be the Marks.
Yeah.
There's lots of Marks in comedy. Two Marks. There was two. There were two Marks on there.
This should be. You know when the my dad was a wrote porno thing.
Yeah.
And they're doing the Albert Hall.
Yeah.
I wonder if they've got a more of that. That's a clue of how to do a podcast. More than if we turn this into a quiz game. And now, welcome to how many people in comedy have this name?
Yeah.
This week, Ding Ted.
There's a TV show that is that now, so it was a slow burn.
I've got an idea for a podcast.
Go on, what is it?
Before we get talking about other things. Right, see if this... What do you reckon on this? I've had loads of discussions with people, and you can throw in any people that you want on this, right? Whether someone is a cunt or a wanker. Now, The other night I was in the pub and I just mentioned this. Within a quarter of an hour, there were arguments going all round the pub. Honestly, Boris Johnson, he's a cunt. No, he's a wanker. He knows what he's doing. He's a cunt. And you could throw in anyone, Eric Bristow, anyone you like. What you're aiming for here, Richard, right, is the jackpot is to get someone who is both. And they are really rare. Yeah. Blair, I think, is the epitome of this. I think he's both.
Yeah.
But it's very, very rare.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good, isn't it?
There's definitely mileage in that.
I did suggest it as a Radio 4 panel show. Robert Robinson, if only he was still around. Ah, cunt or wanker. Would that it were, Mr. Nesbitt. No, indeed. Noel Edmonds is a cunt. We move on. Brilliant, wouldn't it?
It's very good. So you have been working as a stand-up comedian since 1982.
Yeah.
This is ages.
Yeah, well, isn't
it? A long time.
Yeah.
And you don't like to talk about what you were doing before. No, you just get fed up of people asking you, What brought you into stand-up?
Oh, God, yeah, well, I did.
So you make up lots.
I did, yeah, no, that's well spotted. No, I did do this a few years ago. Well, this started because I was asked, one of the first sort of, I don't know, one of the biggest things I've been asked to go on, I think, it was midweek at the time back in, I don't know, back in about 1990 time, midweek with Libby Purvis.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's a big thing. And then some researcher, you know, the score with these things. So a researcher rings up and they ask you various things that might crop up on the program. And this researcher said, well, have you done, how did you get started in comedy? And I said, oh, it's just not very interesting. Because it really isn't very interesting. It's most of us have got, we just fancied doing it. We saw someone, we thought I'd like to do it. I said, it's just not very interesting. Then you bring up some theatres and clubs and all that. And then she said, well, you know, we'd like to talk about it. I said, it's not. I said, I could make something up if you like, but, you know, that there's no point in that. She said, well, go on, do that then. I said, well, all right then. I said, right, my dad, right, was Polish. And he was a manager at this plant, a car plant in Poland. And I used to have to go over there with him every Christmas and he'd have to make a speech. And then it's the tradition in Poland that when the manager of a car plant makes a speech to all the people in the room, that their son has to get up and say something as well. And that, funny, I don't know if you know this about Polish, but one of the easiest ways to learn Polish is to learn the jokes. So I got up and I told a couple of Polish jokes and they went down so well that I was booked to do a regular slot at the canteen during the lunch break in a nearby vodka factory, right? So anyway, I just said this, right? Anyway, I thought nothing more of it, and about 3 days later, I was on the air. I hope this exists somewhere. And then it comes, Libby's talked to someone who's, you know, gone up and down the Thames on a bath or something, or discovered a new species of giraffe, or who's on the programme. And then she says, and now I turn to a comedian who had indeed, Mark Steele, you had a rather extraordinary start to the world of comedy. I said, did I, though? Well, Mark's being rather obtuse, a little bit modest, if I may say. I can tell the listeners, no, Mark started with his father as a Polish diplomat. No! And she read all this out. Nearby vodka factory. So from then on, I thought, I'm going to keep doing this. And I wish I'd kept them, but I've done loads of these, and they get printed. I told one local paper, I said, I've always been really scared of flying, and I found that one of the only ways that I could keep calm was I'd just rattle out jokes. And there was once, there was a really severe bit of turbulence on a plane, and I just rattled out so many jokes, everyone just started laughing. The captain heard about it. They said that was a really calm load of passengers given the amount of turbulence. And someone said, yeah, there was a bloke there telling loads of jokes. So I got booked to do a regular slot on the London to Dublin shuttle service. And I got... And then I kept doing this. Right? And it's a bollocks, the flaws. Think of the flaws in that. And then there was, I did one where I said, I used to play football for Bexley Academicals, right? I was terrible. I was so bad, we'd always be 2-0 down at half time. And then I'd tell a load of jokes during the half time interval, and it spurred the team on so much, we'd always win 3-2. Loads and loads of these.
They'll go, why don't you tell the jokes before the first half?
I know. The holes in the plot, there are so many, aren't there? Like an episode of Crossroad. Why didn't you?
I just find with the local newspapers, they make enough mistakes on their own anyway. You'll say something and then it just goes, why didn't say anything like that?
It was one. Oh, what was it? I'm not going to remember this right. It was one of those. Yeah, she rang up. Oh, bless her, one of her fault. She was Maidstone advertiser. And she just obviously just bored, so you don't have a clue I was. And she said, got a load of questions. She said, have you ever been to Kent before? One of those sorts of supermarket checkout voices. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, yeah, well, yeah, yeah, I was brought up in Kent. She said, oh, right, well, how did you get started in comedy? So I thought, oh, here we go. I said, well, I used to work on the Gravesend Tilbury ferry, and you know, you have to do all them poor people. You know, on your left, you see Dartford. On your right, going up the Isle of Sheppey, and all that. So I used to liven it up by telling jokes about the Essex people, right? And the Kent people loved it, but the Essex people hated it. And then there'd be fights and everything. But I got the sack. But I was booked up to do a regular slot in a comedy club in Sittingbourne because it could become so funny. And they printed this. Oh, that's right. And then she said, it says here you've written the book. Can you tell me what the book's about? And I said, well, it's a children's book. I wrote a children's book. But I just thought there's a gap in the market here, really, because a lot of people say that with the kids' books, children's books, there's not enough swearing in them. And I just thought kids would love it, you know, not enough kids reading books these days, and they'd love it more if it was, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk was like, three fucking beans, you twat, you fucking, fucking out of your, see, fucking cow, and you've got that, what the fuck use is that, you fucking mate? And she said, it all got printed, Mark's controversial career continues.
You got a book deal. There's plenty of the books. So you were in the kind of thick of it of the 80s alternative comedy then. So you saw you were on with all these kind of crazy acts and that I'm always fascinated about in the 80s.
Ah, now I'm glad you say that, Richard, because that is absolutely... There's a myth about at the 80s comedy scene that it was all sort of very uber political, but it wasn't that at all. It was variety, really. Mm. It was, in fact, one of the main gigs was called New Variety, and it was a sort of slightly modernised version of what was the old music hall, in a way. Yeah, strangely, yeah. I mean, it was absolutely crazy acts, absolutely bonkers. It was brilliant. Which, I mean, you must have caught some of them.
We have sort of the Iceman and
Iceman. For people who don't know,
he was a man who just had a big block of ice that he lay down on and melted. That was his act.
Yeah. But there was a brilliant thing in there, wasn't there? Where there's about a minute, the audience is like, what's this? And then they thought, oh, it's funny because he's doing this and then he's going to do something. And then at about 6 minutes, it was, fuck's sake.
It's just such a complicated, you know, like the part of the funniness was just imagine him getting the ice to the venue.
Stuck in a taxi. Fucking dripping. Can you hurry up, mate? Or on his files. I hope you're mopping that up at the back. he didn't realise he's getting the act for free in his mirror.
Are there any that you remember that don't get spoken of very much?
Oh, God, I'm not too good. There was one... I remember one day I was somewhere... I think it was Essex University, and there was a bloke, a Geordie bloke. He was a nice bloke, but he was an escapologist. And he did this act. I was going on after him, and he said, I'll come out. We introduce each other. I'll come out. I'll do this thing in a sack, right? I'll get out the sack, and then I'll introduce you. I said, all right. So I've gone sort of back behind the curtains and I'm waiting for him. Oh, this was one of the first gigs I'd done out of London. And he's got some student out, a team, and a Sutner. The bloke's done all that. And then he's got a minute or 2 minutes or something. And I'm just sort of peeking through the curtains and I can see this student sort of still stood there. And time, I thought, God, he's dragging this on for theatrical sort of reasons. And then eventually there's a murmuring. Then I hear this voice from in the middle of a sack, Mark, are you there? Can you come and get me out, man? I'm fucking stuck. I'm not joking. I'm fucking stuck. and I just sort of walk on the next act. You know, I can't hang on. You've done it a bit tight, mate. Fucking still can't fucking breathe, man.
It'd be good if that was his act every time, though. Yeah. See what the next act does.
God, I know there were some terrible ones. I used to do the comparing at a place called the Canal Cafe Theatre, which is a lovely place, Little Venice. And that was, it was a sort of mixture of people there, but a lot of the time it was a sort of open mic thing. But whereas I think now the open mic nights, most of the people doing it, they've got enough people to copy, haven't they, that they're all trying to, you know, I don't mean to be disparaging about it, some are probably very good, but they're trying to do some copy someone that they know or something. But they do at least know how to. But then the people were just all over the place, mad. And there was it was really going bad one night. And then there was this bloke on, he just said he just wanted to be called Cyril. And he just, I got this piano and he was just banging the piano with his fists and stuff, you know. And I remember I had to go and drag him off, and I'm sort of going, oh, he's on children's television next week now. Like, fuck off, I'm playing the piano. Oh, God.
But it felt like that, even when I was doing it, it felt like there's every chance that it could just be someone who was properly mentally ill comedian mentally ill. there's a big blurred area in the middle of that anyway. But it was, you know, there was some properly, I mean, it's like with that open spot thing, it's people are either very nervous and scared, which is a natural reaction, or just ridiculously confident. And often the best people are ridiculously confident, but also the very worst people are ridiculously confident.
I think that's like that in most things, isn't it? You see that in sport or something. You'll get the person will go, yeah, I can play cricket or whatever, and then the bold first ball.
They rarely get to go out into a major game, though, do they? That's the most thing. Oh, you can play, can you? Oh, you can go for England.
Like test matches. Well, only the banner for England is Neil from the pub. What a fucking easy, isn't it? All you do is hit the fucking ball, isn't it?
Smashing the wickets. Oh dear! I was reading you on quite a lot of the early Loose Ends or the earlier Loose Ends.
Ned Sheeran was. I actually did a thing about cricket, and he was a cricket fan, and so he was. He said, "Oh, can you? Yes, would it be lovely if you could come back and do something regular?" And I went on and went on there quite regularly. And that's about the first time, I suppose, that I thought, oh, that'd be, you know, the exciting thing where you do something and then it's not just the people in the room that have heard it, and someone comes up and goes, oh, I heard you on that programme. That's a thrill, isn't it, when that happens?
No, exactly, yeah. And they always had like a quite an eclectic mixture of
people
on those shows.
Oh, you'd meet mad people on there. I went to Joseph Heller. Right. Joseph Heller, I remember, and he come round the pub, and I sort of, Britt Eklund. And then sort of there was this little tradition, and Ned Sheeran would go into the little pub that's just next to the BBC and go, no, I shall buy the first round, and you just sort of, you'd go up and get in the big pork pies, and you'd be sat there with Britt Eklund in the corner of the pub and stuff. I don't know, it was quite odd thing, that, isn't it, to be, you know, when you first meet people like that, and then, you know, God, Britt Eklund. The pub. Joan Bakewell.
Yeah. Gary Glitter, I read. Do you
mean? Yes, he was on one once. Yeah, I met him. Yeah. Yeah, exciting, isn't it?
It is.
I've met one of Britain's leading paedophiles.
I grew up in Cheddar in Somerset. He lived in Wedmore with his 15-year-old girlfriend. It was fine at the time, no one minded. It was a different time. Yeah. Long as the mum and dad said it was okay, it was all right. That's how it was, wasn't it? Better times. You had to ask the mum and dad, do you mind if I live with your 15-year-old daughter?
Yeah.
They said yes, that was okay.
Yeah, as long as you come out and sing hello, hello and back again every now and again for the neighbours. Raise money for the allotment. Can't do it these days. Political correctness gone mad, hasn't it? Can't do nothing. See, once we're out of the EU, they'll scrap all them fucking regulations. Got a couple of number one records, you'll be able to go back there with your 15-year-old daughter again.
And
fucking terrible, isn't it? Can't do nothing. Perfectly honourable man, ruined by the EU with their fucking paedophilic red tape.
if he'd gone and lived in the EU, it'd have been fine. That's the irony. So,
I love it. Angry people. They're so angry. Why aren't we? We should have left. We voted to leave. Why haven't we left? We are leaving. Yeah, what? We should be leaving. Well, we are leaving. Well, right, well, we should come back in then and then leave again. And do it twice a week. That fucking teach them to be Belgian. I was listening to James O'Brien.
Yes.
It's really funny to listen to James O'Brien. He's this phoning on LBC because he just does this. He does it all of this sort of tired, fed up sort of. And he's very erudite, and he just got his old program. He's just going, oh Jesus, like that. And there was one. There's a brilliant one. I've watched it about five times. As you can see it on the YouTube thing. And a bloke goes, we could probably trade now with everyone we're going to trade with. You know, we want to trade with now. We're not in the EU, aren't we? Better off. He said, oh, right, well, who are we going to trade with now that's going to make up for the EU, Dave? Well, you know, all them places we used to run. We can trade with them again, can't we? He said, what do you mean? He said, well, I mean, we used to run 3/3 of the world, didn't we? this bored way that he goes, yeah, that Dave, that's all the world. Yeah, whatever. You know, don't matter. One of them thirds, you know, it's all them thing. But and then he goes, right, he says, now if they don't want to sell us, you know, the cars, wine, whatever it is, right? If they don't want to sell us that, right, we get back at them, right? We say when you want to come to this country, right, you queue up all day, we're not gonna let you in, nothing, right? 8 hours, customs, all that, right? There you are, that'll fucking, you know, I wouldn't swear, but you know, that'll sort it, whatever. James Ryan went, okay. He said, but then they're going to do the same to you if you want to go to France. And he went, yeah, but I don't want to go to France. Brilliant. That this bloke thinks Britain's entire economic and political strategy for the next 50 years should be based on where he wants to go on holiday. We're trading with France, right? I don't want to go there. What's the point of that?
I want to have a blue passport, but I don't want to use it. It must be, it must be great for you, all of this, in terms of your fantastic columns you write for The Independent now.
Oh, well, thanks.
You've got all of these. I mean, is it harder to write about these things because they're so ridiculous, or is it? I mean,
for doing that column I do, you just need someone to have said something mad, yeah. Really, and then you're away, yeah. So something like that. That bloke's brilliant. Because then you can follow that logic through, I suppose, is the thing. Yeah, it's not a place for writing any sort of nuanced art. And people take it serious. It's a brilliant thing with the... I mean, I suppose people always did, but they didn't have a voice. But now, so no matter how mad a thing, you put, people all on the comments and Twitter and that, then you get all the stuff. That's ridiculous what you're saying. It's meant not. Don't take it literally. There was one I put... I loved one I put about Putin. And I referred to him... I think I've got the words right. It's about 3 weeks ago. I referred to Putin as a homophobic, gangster, racist, criminal, oligarch, thug, moron, idiot or something. And someone wrote a reply going... Any criticism of Putin from you, Mark? No, I thought not. But that's not enough. Didn't call him a cunt, mate, did you? That's your trouble.
Well, it does feel like, from Twitter, it feels very much... You know, I'll joke about most things, and there's certain subjects that you'll get people going, why are you doing... exactly that. Why are you joking about Corbyn? Why are you joking about Trump? Yeah, why are you joking about Brexit? You wouldn't joke about the opposite. You wouldn't, you know... And yet you are doing all those jokes and then everyone's homing in on the one that affects them, which used to be like a comedy club. There'd be one person go laughing and then you'd make a joke that was too close to their home for them.
Yeah,
and they'd go,
And
they'd get upset and you'd go, you're an idiot. Look, you know, you've been laughing at all the other things.
Yeah, exactly,
can't.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Now people just sort of almost blinkered to not even see it when you're...
It's probably no more than it was. They're just people who just... And they take everything literally. It's probably not many people. I was doing a joke, actually, about there's nothing you could write. There's no collection of words you could write on Twitter that wouldn't offend someone somewhere. I was saying, you could put, I'm enjoying a delightful sunset across Dorset this evening. And someone would put, not so delightful if you suffer from sunset aversion Dorset syndrome, actually. But have a thought for sad sufferers in future, please. And this is true. I wrote something about, I mentioned, I did a bit about Trump, and I just, I don't know, I can't remember what I put, but I mentioned in passing he was a psychopath, right? And like four people, of all the replies I got, four people sent me messages saying, please don't add to the stigma against psychopaths. They're suffering as well, you know. They've got nowhere to put their salad because their fridge is full of heads.
So you were in the Socialist Workers' Party.
Yeah, I was. I joined it when I was about 18, yeah.
So what attracted you to that?
Oh, God, how do I say this without being incredibly tedious? Well, I was sort of... when I was a teenager, I thought, I like the idea of socialism and stuff. It doesn't seem fair, you know, the people at the top of society, they're not the best people, they're the people who... And they're certainly not the people you'd want in charge. Oh, I don't know, don't like that. Things made me very cross. And this was the late 70s as well, so it was a very fervent sort of atmosphere. It was a very, much more than now, polarised situation. Mm. I think what had happened is that the post-war sort of boom, if you like, where everything must have felt like it was getting a little bit better every year in the 50s and 60s for working class people. And that sort of kept a little consensus going, kept things sort of calm. But then in the 70s, when the first post-war crash happened, loads of the older generation became furious. They hated they seemed to blame us. Look at you with your long hair and all that sort of thing. So it made, so it's very polarised. And then obviously a lot of people in... A lot of people blamed the sudden breakdown in society as they saw it on all sorts of, you know, on black people and stuff like that. So there was the rise of National Front. So that was the time. But socialists seemed to... It was Russia. Russia was a communist country. And I thought, well, that's rubbish. You know, that can't be an ideal. So the Socialist Workers' Party, they were against the Soviet Union. Mm. So that sort of... attracted me to that, really. Yeah. You know, if only I'd spotted that they were mental. but that side of it, I'd stand by that. I don't think the Soviet Union was in any way horrible dictatorship.
Yeah, but it's similar. I mean, like you're saying, it's interesting that politics is becoming that divided again. And
it is a bit, yeah.
People are very passionate. The people on the left who are more on the left are very passionate again about those socialist ideas, and you know, and very intransient to anyone criticising it. So it's you can understand the passion of it, and as a young person getting caught up in the passion and the right, you know, it's right. You know,
I think most people attracted by Corbyn I do think things through properly, but of course there's a number of people who will just go, anyone makes any criticism of anything, rather than go, okay, right, well, let's... All right, maybe there's something in what they say. Maybe we're, or at the very least, maybe we're not getting our ideas across properly. So maybe we should rethink how we. Instead of that, they just go, "Oh, so you fascist, you fucking blah blah blah," and off they go. And then, of course, you know, but they're the people who go on Facebook and all that. You know, the angry, you know, don't add to the stigma against psychopaths people, don't they?
Yeah, and you stood for the London Assembly, and you got quite a lot of votes.
No, I didn't.
It was a
stupid thing to do, Richard. That's quite stupid. You can't if you're a comic. I got asked to do it, and it's probably an ego thing. I thought, oh, that'd be fun. But it was a bonkers thing to do, to stand for a comic, because you can't take anything seriously. It's hard to, you know, I'd get up at a thing and do a few jokes and that, and think, oh, that went well. Not a single bird. You've just got people, well, that funny bloke, I'm not voting for him. So that's not... My favourite moment of it was, it got me no votes, which was outside this college, and we were giving out some leaflets, and there were these two like young lads, and like 17, and they took a leaflet, and one of them went, like, blood, this is good shit, bruv. You get me in it, like, you know what I mean, bruv? This is just what I want, fam, you know? Like, I'm going to vote for you, bruv. And his mate says, you can't vote, man, you know? You've got to be 18, you're only 17, innit? And he says, I can get around that, I've got connections, bruv. He goes... I loved him for that.
So you think that, because I sort of sometimes think maybe, you know, comedians might be a better... No, the comedians are quite intelligent and thoughtful people, and like if you actually, and occasionally this has happened where a comedian's got a political movement going, and it's sort of done in Italy and places. And
well,
it's
we're recording this on the day when Eddie's gone on to the National Executive of the Labour Party. Which good luck to him. I really like Eddie, and I think he'll do really well. But you can't do that and be a comic. That's because especially not now, because people will just miss it. If you do a joke, you know, then it's just going to be all over the even people who know exactly what they're doing, they're just going to misinterpret it, aren't they, and put your joke. John O'Farrell wrote a book about being in the Labour Party, and he, in this book, Things Can Only Get Better, it was a really good book about being in the Labour Party through the Thatcher years, and he mentioned about how, for a moment at the time when the Brighton bomb happened, there was a moment where he thought, good, he said, and then he thought, I hated myself for thinking that and all that sort of thing. But he just a very honest thing about his, you know, when he was 22 when it happened and all that. And then when he stood for election, that was the front page in the newspapers, because they went, look, you know, Labour candidate is mad terrorist, bombing person. I mean, God, if they were to trawl through all the things, imagine now, if I was to stand for election now, Labour candidate wants debate on cunt or wanker shop. We contacted the people in charge of the Robert Robinson estate. We are shocked and angered at Mr. Steele's sad, sick comments.
Yeah.
We still feel his death every day.
The trick is to do so much stuff that it's impossible for any journalist to have the time to listen through it all. That's my hope for becoming Prime Minister. What do you mean I said I wanted the audience to be killed? What? I never said that. He's calling for his own side to be murdered. Is this the man we want in charge? Yes, he can do no wrong. Look, I'm very interested in... I didn't see this at the show you did about finding your birth parents, or finding out about your birth parents, because you were, as many comedians are, you were adopted. A disproportionate amount of comedians seem to
I'm
be
not
adopted.
Sure. Well, you know, Stuart.
Stuart and Rob Newman and Rona Cameron.
Yeah, quite a lot are adopted. The short version of this story. So I was adopted. I had no idea, I had no interest in trying to pursue my natural mother, certainly not my father. So I was brought up in Swanley, which is a little sort of working-class town in Kent. And then all I knew is that the my aunt, the woman I came to know as my aunt, she had been living in a flat in West London, and this woman moved in next door, in the next door sort of flat in the same house, and she was 19, and she was obviously in a right state, and my aunt said to her, you know, what's the matter, love? And she said, I'm pregnant, I've run away from home, I don't know what to do. And so my aunt said, well, my brother and his wife live in a place called Swanley in Kent, they want to have kids and can't have kids, why don't you have the baby and give it to them? And that's pretty much what happened. It was like, you know, before the EU meddled around and made us fill in loads of forms when you want to give a baby away.
You can just go up to a pregnant woman and say, yeah, we'll take that baby.
Yeah, we'll have it. Honestly, I reckon you'd have to fill in more forms now to get a guinea pig. So that was my adoption. And my aunt used to tell me that story. And all she ever told me about my father was she said, oh, yeah, Francis, that was my natural mum's name. She said, Francis used to say that the father was French. As I say, the show, you know, so as I got older, I'd tell that to people and they'd say things like, well, that explains why you like cheese. And that, so there was none of that. And I was always knew I was adopted. There was never one of them things, you know, Mark, you know. You're six, time you learnt something, one of those things, there's something to tell you, you're very special. Yes, you are, because you were chosen specially. You're not like the other boys and girls whose mummies and daddies have to keep them even if they hate the bastards. Because you're special. So there was none of that, and that, I just grew up no interest. So I had a son of my own, sounds cliche, but then I for the first time I thought, oh, yes, she will remember me. You do remember having a kid, don't you? I thought, she'd be bothered. That was ages ago. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, very few people have kids. And then years later go, didn't we used to have a child. So I thought I'd try and find her, and I went to some length to try and find her. It took years and years, and but then I'd stop for 3 years and then start again and so on. And then I had one of these sort of people who's now on the telly, this woman, who's extraordinarily efficient at finding people. Okay, Mark, because a bit of information came through from some, I can't remember where now, that showed that she was Scottish, that my natural mother was Scottish, and a family had moved down from Scotland to North London, and they'd been, and then I'd been born at this time, and she owned a delicatessen in this little town called Dunkeld in Scotland. And once I got this bit of information, I thought, oh, we've got the address. So I took it to one of these people who manages to locate people, and yeah. She was all, oh, marvellous, delicatessen, oh, we've got all these different forms, everything, absolutely splendid, don't worry, give me about 2 weeks and I'll be able to get straight onto it. And so she found the natural mother in Rimini, and she got in touch with her because we sent a letter. The natural mother didn't reply. So then, because this woman had a phone number, she rang her up, and then she reported the phone call back to me. And she said, it was extraordinary, Mark. She said, I'm afraid she didn't... She certainly doesn't want to meet you. She said, but I did manage to keep her on the phone. She said, and eventually she said, I would like to ask 3 questions. Right. She said, the first question was, what does he do? And I said, well, he's a comedian. The second question was, does he have any children of his own? I said, yes, he does. He has a son and a daughter. She said, and then she asked a third question. I have to say, in all the many years that I've been performing this role of reconnecting erstwhile estranged members of the family, like lost pieces of a jigsaw or whatever. She said, in all those years, not once do I remember anybody ever asking such a question as that which she then posed. She said, and what are his politics? And that is weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is an extraordinary thing to think. So, and then she said, before I put the phone down, let me tell you who the father is. And so I thought, she's the father, because I'd never had any hint. It never even occurred to me to even ask who the father was. You know, I just thought it was some random French bloke, 1960. What is your name, Francis? Would you like to accompany me to the bus shelter? And I thought, what, the father? And I thought, for about a second, I thought, I bet it's De Gaulle. And then and she said this name, Joe Dweck. And we looked up Joe Dweck, and fairly quickly it became apparent that this man, my actual father, was, amongst other things, the 1976 World Backgammon Champion, who then invested his money that he'd made out of becoming the World Backgammon Champion, which was millions, into Wall Street, and he became one of the Wall Street traders, worth more millions than you could count, and his best mate, the circle in which he moved, I mean, not just who he had a drink with, the circle in which he moved was a group of people at the Claremont Club in Berkeley Square, and the Claremont Club was the establishment club where the richest people in the world, the Arab millionaires, whatever, the Russian, well, before the Russian oligarchs, but those sorts of people would come and meet, and they would play backgammon. And his closest confidants that he went round the world with was these people, older people who'd remember the name, Tiny Rowlands, Jim Slater, Kerry Packer, and Lord Lucan. And so he was part of that, right, part of that world. So if I'd all of that had happened and I'd not been able to write a decent show about it, that would have been really poor, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Well, and your mum was very socialist and that he's very...
Yeah. She was... So. Yes, well, I met my natural mother's sisters. Right. Before she died at first, but... I never met my natural mother. She stayed in Italy, didn't want to know. But I met them, yeah, and they were extraordinary business sort of meeting them. And they were, yeah, they were all very sort of on the left, and Denise clearly not on the left. One of the only communist multimillionaire Wall Street trader, backgammon champions, friends of Lord Lucan. All the arguments we used to have.
And you did meet him, though.
I did meet him, yeah. And a Sephardic Jew from Egypt.
Right.
Nothing to do with France at all. Okay. That was a lie.
That's why you like cheese.
Yeah. That'll be why you like pyramids.
That's why you like Toblerones. That's why.
I don't know. No, it does seem it's a very, very strange, thing, you know, but it hasn't made any difference other than I've written this show about it. But
yeah.
He bought me a cup of coffee when I met him, so that's...
I mean, he didn't know. Well, he thought that you'd been got rid of.
Yes, he thought that... when he met me, he told me... Well, he'd already told me this in an email. He said that when he... the last he'd known about Frances was she'd got in touch with him and said that she was pregnant, and he had then met up with her and borrowed some money from his dad, who had arranged an abortion,
right?
Which was a tricky thing to do in 1967.
Yeah.
So he says in the email anyway. So, so that's what he said. So then when I met him, he said, and he was, I sort of imagined him being very Jewish, which he is very Jewish, but he doesn't actually talk like that. But he said, last I knew, you were, last I heard, like I said, and I said, yeah, don't worry. I said, look, I'll tell you what, I'm actually in touch with her family now. So if you like, I can ask for the money back that they obviously owe you. And he sort of went. I said, no, it was a better joke than that in the circumstance. Yeah, maybe. And then,
it's weird if you're in that situation and you discovered you had like a son you didn't know about. I mean, it's hard to imagine, I suppose. It's possible, but you'd think.
Yeah, I would be. I'd think, whoa, this is exciting, wouldn't I? You can just go there, meet up, have a cup of coffee, and then we've not met again since.
No.
But, I got on with him, but I don't know. I should imagine if we carried on meeting, bit by bit, differences of opinion might begin to emerge. They seemed all right. I liked him.
Yeah. You've got to get in there. There's a lot of money there, Mark. Yeah. Some of that's yours.
Yeah, I know. he owned a house, right? He owned a house worth that he bought for $11 million in California, and he bought it off of Luther Vandross, the soul singer. That's just one ass class, isn't it? Not just any $11 million Californian extra house.
Yeah.
Oh, only buy houses if they're off soul singer. got a bungalow from Diana Ross.
It's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary story, which you did as a show, as any comedian would be delighted to find out.
That's how rotten we are. Yeah. Something like that can emerge in your life and you think, oh, thank fuck for that. That's Edinburgh sorted.
It's quite rare to hear a story where the people find their birth family and the birth... I mean, I know the aunts and stuff have seen more of them. But mostly it's a sort of happier outcome than that in terms of meeting up.
Yeah, if it was a soap opera, it'd all be tears and things, wouldn't it? But it's not really going to be like that. I think that was a happy ending in a way because I sort of met him and we got on and that was all right and off we went. That was that was all right really. I don't and you're not going to. That's also, I do say, I mean, I'm trying to remember now in the show, because I said, one of the consequences of it was, of course, from then on, whenever I saw an episode of Who Do You Think You Are, I'd go, I can piss on that, mate. Really, Sebastian Coe, your ancestors were slave owners. Well, that's took us all by surprise, isn't it? Sebastian Coe, cunt or wanker?
Yeah, might be both. And your son is a comic as well.
Yeah.
So how are you finding that? That's sort of in my. I don't really want to do this to them, but I sort of have a joke about training my children up to be super comedians and taking vengeance on the world for not realising how brilliant I was. is that how you view it with your son?
Well, he goes his own way, which is right, really. And for a long while, every now and again, he'll sort of say, oh, how do you reckon this should work or something, and then take no notice of me. But there were certain things. I would say this. I know this is true. There were two moments where I thought, oh, that is a comic sort of way of thinking. He was nine, so this would be Yeah, I know it's 12 years ago because it was three World Cups ago, right? So, and it, that's mad because it, so it was leading up to a little bit before this time of year when they did the draw for the World Cup, right? And so he was nine, and I said, Elliot, I said, the World Cup draw's on. Do you want to come and watch it? And he went, what's the point? Even if we're drawn against Easter Island, we'll lose to the statues. Nine, that's pretty good, isn't it? And then, I'll often sort of tell this story, but he was a mate who he's still very much mates with, who's Polish. He introduced me to this lad who's Polish. And he said, is my new mate dad Polish? I said, oh, how are you doing? He said, oh, don't worry, Dad. He said, I do jokes all the time. He said, I don't miss any opportunity. I do jokes all the time about Poland. I said, all right. He said, yeah, especially about the war. He says, because they'd have been stuffed without us in the war. I said, I'm doing jokes about it all the time. I said, do you? Right, listen. Right. You know the battle, right, at the start of the war, right? The RAF, all that, Spitfires, right? What meant Hitler couldn't come here. He went, oh, Battle of Britain. Battle of Britain, right? I said, one in five of the pilots, you know where they come from? Poland, right? And he turned straight to his mate, he said, see, you were nicking our jobs even back then. So, and he was useless at everything else, just like comics.
It's a weird book. You know, I think being a comedian's a great job, and I love it myself. But it's sort of a weird thing to wish on someone else as well, isn't it? It's a nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Oh, as a parent. God, the nerves. When I've seen him go, I'm not quite so now. The first two or three times I'd see him walk on, and oh, just the nerves of it. Yeah. I've never seen him go really badly. So, but yeah, then he's sort of. This is what anyone says when I said, oh, he's going to do stand up. What all the other comics say is you'll know when if he's going to stick at it. Not because he's gone well, but because he's gone badly.
Yeah.
And then still, because any normal, sane person going through the experience of going in front of people and having them all just go, fuck off, mate, and all that, and shut up, wanker, and all that. Normal people would go, I'm not doing that again. But any comic goes, I'm going to do that again tomorrow. So, he clearly did.
But I think it's harder now for the, you know, there seems to be so much competition now. And as you say, it's more homogenised in terms of what the circuit is. And, even when I started the circuit, it felt like there's 40, 50 people doing it, maybe.
Oh, now there's thousands, isn't there?
So I just don't know how anyone can even see their way through that.
Well, the odd thing, you know, when at NAM days, if you said you were a comedian, it was like saying you were an astronaut. Ooh, do you hear that? Ooh, and that, but now people go, oh yeah, my neighbours' kids are both doing stand up. everyone's doing it.
It's easy, Mark. That's the thing. It's an easy well, rant.
There's a thing in me shows about the towns are doing the radio.
Yeah.
So I like. I mean, it depends really on people in the towns. And every time, it's never failed, this bit. There are people in the towns who are passionate about their town. I could see it how it would be funny from an outside point of view. So they go, oh, you've got to come and look at this mad thing we do here. And they're very passionate, very funny about it. And then they'll sit in front of an audience and tell a story. So the last one I did in the last series was Hull. And there was a couple of really... I mean, the people in the audience, there's a little plinth thing by the harbour. That they put because Hull was city of culture. And you speak into this thing. This is astonishing. And about a quarter of a mile down this straight road, there's a tower. And whatever you say in this little plinth lights up on this tower. So you could say, I'm doing a podcast. And it'll say, I'm doing a podcast. And come up in big lights, which I find utterly staggering that this can happen. So, of course, what did every single person in Hull... Yeah, go on, fuck shit, bitch won't bollock, fuck shit. So they had to reprogram this thing. So that it didn't put up swear words. So I said to the audience on the night, I said, so what's the rudest word anyone's managed to say into it and it's come up? And straight away a bloke went, Leeds! And that's a cracking bit of improvising, isn't it?
It's got to be able to do it more than once. The thing of being a heckler is if you get one, shut up forever. If you get the brilliant heckle, either become a comedian or shut up forever. Because you'll never beat it. I was watching in the dressing room the Mark Steele lectures. I was just thinking, that you did on, was that Channel 4 or?
BBC 4.
BBC 4. And I was just thinking, would anything like that get made now? It's like incredibly, so these are your lectures about historical figures. So Aristotle lucky. I was watching and Darwin. Mm. And they're so erudite. I mean, A, it's so hard to get any stand-up on TV now. It's all panel shows and it's all, you know, presenting jobs. But it's not that long ago. It's like
12 years ago,
And it just, it almost seemed like comic that was allowed. It was a very funny show.
Well, I think we were lucky.
Why have they allowed a comedian to go and talk about Aristotle? This is insane.
Yeah,
but of course it isn't insane.
And we'd sort of tried to do it, the rules of it, as stand-up, so it had to be jokes all the way through, but telling the real story of Aristotle and what he was about and stuff. Yeah, I love doing that. Because at first I had to find out really try to fathom out what these people were about. And you'd go, and I did one on Einstein. And of course this was driving me. I'd read the same two pages about the theory of relativity over and over. My lad was about 8 at the time. And I remember I was sat in the bath, and then I looked up at my lad, and he must have been stood there for a while, and he went, oh, my God, my dad sat in the bath talking about the speed of light. And I thought, yeah, I am going nuts here. But yeah, they let us do it, and I think it was because BBC Four was just starting at the time.
Yeah.
And so they sort of go, we don't quite know how we're going to sort of run this thing, so you go off and make that, because I've done it on the radio.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant fun. Yeah,
I mean, you got to do Aristotle. You were in Greece and Parthenon, and
that was great, brilliant fun. Yeah. That one, because there was you go to these places and they have someone who's supposed to show you round. So the BBC have someone designated person who's their Athens person. But this bloke, he was just like a Greek comedy character, and he hadn't done anything. And he said, "Oh, we've got all these locations for you to film in." And when we got there, he said, "I've got to admit, like, I haven't really done nothing." And so we had to just do it on street corners and stuff. And we had to sneak in, like John Peel just sneaking into places with secret cameras. And that was brilliant fun. Yeah.
It's
not for any great, you know, great investigative reason. It was just so I could do joke about Aristotle while stood by a column.
True. I mean, there was jokes in it, and it's really funny, but it is completely educated. You find out all about those. There's a lot of work in there. So they're all like a little Edinburgh, half an hour Edinburgh show.
Yeah, yeah. My favourite one was there. There was one about, I think it was about Noel Edmonds, actually. It was like, it was what makes something, Aristotle was concerned with what makes something what it is. And he said everything has an essence of what, so a table, you could sort of plane it, you could maybe even chop a leg off it. You could do all sorts of things to it. It would still remain a table. But there is an essence inside it that makes it a table. If you remove that, then it ceases to be what it is. For example, Noel Edmonds keeps changing. He was on the radio, then he was on the television, then he's just in the newspapers, but remains throughout, in essence, a deeply nauseating twat. And somehow we were allowed to say that. It's a way of explanation of Aristotle's theory.
But I think comedy is such a great way to get, you know, information across. People will enjoy something, and it makes complicated ideas digestible, I think.
Maybe, yeah. I just remembered, actually, because they were sponsored by the Open University, and they was their sort of lecturers were split. Some of them really liked it, but some of them just hated it, because you can imagine, not taking the subject seriously, it's absolutely demeaning to the whole practice. Education is just plummeting downhill with this nonsense, frivolous, irrelevant, all this sort of thing. So there was one bloke on the Darwin programme. We had to go and meet him for the day, and we sent him the script, and he hated it. And he went through every single little bit going, that bit there, that's wrong there, that's... we should have a comma there, surely, rather than a semicolon. I would think it's important to get... when we say it, it doesn't matter whether you get things right or not. Do you care? And then, there was the ship's doctor that Darwin replaced when he went on the Beagle, the trip where he went around the world, you know, and that led to him discovering the theory of natural selection. So... it was called McCulloch, and he said, look at this here, McCulloch, you've spelled him with one C, two C's, and McCulloch, everybody knows that, what's the matter with you? And every page, McCulloch again there, important to make that a difference there. I'll try and say it with both C's in it. I'm not very well being frivolous about it, but these things matter. And I swear this happened. He said, look at this, this quote here, this is very important, this quote here, you've attributed to Darwin. Darwin said no such thing. Where on earth did you get this? It's absolutely scandalous if we're going to try and pass this off as a programme that's about Darwin when it clearly isn't anything remotely close to the truth. Where on earth did you get that? And it was, so it was like a moment you dream about, because I thought, I know where I got that. I got that from your book. and I said, I got that from your book. And he just went, then the next page. Brilliant fun doing it, though.
Yeah. Is it a shame that that couldn't happen now? Or do you think it could happen now?
Could it happen now? Probably not.
I mean, you could do it as a podcast now, but then it would be a podcast without you going to Athens. So
yeah,
unless
yeah.
You could
or
really
do it
get some crowd
do it as a panel show, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But you could do it on your own, you know, and you could, but then...
Yeah, yeah, I suppose
you know,
so.
I mean, it would still, interesting, I think, you know, you're still obviously doing radio shows, and the radio is a place where you... They'll let you experiment a bit more than the TV, I think, now. But
Yeah. Well, I think loads of comics are trying. There's loads of brilliant things on there, aren't
yeah.
there? Yeah. But that's, I don't know, that's great. I can't grumble, can I? I did it 3 years of it. It's not fair. I want to do more of it. I want to go to more silly countries.
Yeah.
But... Brilliant. I can't believe they sent us. I mean, because to be honest, we didn't need to go to these places, but they sort of insisted.
Right.
And went to Bolivia to do the Che Guevara. I think they sort of couldn't quite work out whether it was a serious documentary. Of course, if you're doing a serious documentary, right, you shall go to Bolivia or Cuba. The Cubans wouldn't let us in
right.
because they said the Che Guevara programme was too rude about Che Guevara.
Right.
And there was a joke in that. Oh, I can't remember that. It was about... Yeah, so there was no opposition movements to the regime that Fidel Castro and Che Guevara overthrew. It was a dictatorial regime, as illustrated in the second Godfather film, right? So very corrupt. And the ruler... There was only one opposition party allowed, but the opposition party leader somewhat sort of skewed his credibility because he had a radio show he was allowed every week. And 1 week, at the end of his radio show, he shot himself. And so I had a joke where I said, I wonder if the Cuban radio was as sort of as cool as Radio 4 would be, because then you just hear... That was the last in the series by the leader of the opposition. So it was full of stuff like that, and they just, you know, they just were furious. Well, this is, you're just making mockery of Che Guevara, so they wouldn't let us do it, so we had to go to Bolivia, and it was, yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I remember there was one bit we had to go on this, there was James Serafinovich, who some people might know, who was brilliant, big scouse bloke, and he was just brilliant, but he was just... huge bloke, but he gets scared very easily. Like the first time I was writing stuff with him, he just went, oh fucking hell, oh God, oh fuck, and I thought something terrible's happened. What? He said, there's a wasp. And so he was like, so this bus, we had to get this bus over this hill in Bolivia to where Che Guevara was shot. And so this bus, and there was some little old bloke smoking away on this little bus as it just went around these windy Italian job type sort of mountain passes. And the back end of the bus would go over this huge mountain. It was quite airy.
Yeah.
And he just lost it. We were about 2 miles away from where we were going, which was still going to take... He just lost it. And he stood up the front. He went, right, stop the fucking bus. I'm getting off. We're all going to die. There's no point. I'm just not going plummeting over the fucking edge. You can go over the edge if you want, but I'm fucking getting off. I'm walking. And so the guide woman, she was from Paraguay, she got up just really calmly. She said, that's fine. If you want to get off, walk. It is straight road around here, you'll find. But I wonder whether a good idea for this area, there is great many wolves. Brilliant. Should have kept that in, shouldn't we?
And you're on tour at the moment? Which I think you're still, by the time this goes out, you'll just about still be on tour.
Yeah, I think so. We're always on tour, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, you got a website. You've reluctantly entered the website world, according to your website. So marksteelinfo.com, is it? Or co.uk?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. So the tour's Every Little Thing's Going to Be All Right.
Every Little Thing's Going to Be All Right, yeah.
And what,
I'm trying to be optimistic.
Yeah.
about everything. Well, I tried to do sort of quite a bit of stuff about the mad sort of couple of years, really, that that's happened. And then all my own world went a little bit AWOR as well, so it's all about that. It's hard to sort of talk about that, though, without making it sound really miserable. I'm trying to be cheery. But, you know, it's just sort of, you just sort of think of jokes, aren't you? And I always feel real cheap when you get this, you know, people go, oh, this must be a brilliant subject that you can really feel that you can get a convey a certain message. And you're just thinking, oh, I just want a joke.
It is great, I think, if you can impart information and knowledge and ideas, and I think you should be trying to do all that as well. But ultimately, the job is about making people laugh. Yeah, and if you're not, you know, doing that, we haven't made anyone laugh for about 3 minutes here. We're both astutely aware.
Terrible, isn't it?
Yeah,
people have no idea that's the terrible mind. That's what's going on in your mind. That if you were doing a speech for your best mate's funeral, that if you went a minute without a laugh, you'd be thinking, fuck, I'm losing it.
But sometimes, I think with this audience, they're quite good.
Yeah, very good.
I regret wishing death on them. I mean, generally, not just tonight, generally. You're as good as all the other night's audiences. They listen, so the silence is often like an amazing thing in a comedy gig, because if people are actually, if you get silence, that's different. So
they've all left.
Well, they've all left. Or they're all listening. If there's a little...
I think when I the first performance I ever did was in this absolutely piss poor poetry group. Jeez, it was bad. And I tried then. That's the last time, really, I tried to do a serious thing without any jokes. And I had this poem. I was about 19 and I was on the dole and I was all angry. And I wrote this huge, long poem about being unemployed, and it was just appalling. And it ended, the last two lines were addressed to Thatcher, because of what I dread, I'd rather you were dead. Right, so that's how it ended. So that gives a measure of it. Right, and then we got booked to do a little. The poetry group got booked to do a little an evening in Dulwich Village. Rather well-to-do place, a poetry society there that met in this rather posh pub, and there was a back room, and there was about 12 people there, and they were really rather, you know, they weren't people that were, you know, they had, weren't, I hadn't bumped into any of them at the Dole office, and so I thought, I remember thinking, I'm going to do this poem, and it's just going to explode everyone apart, and they'll either be sick, which will serve them right, or they'll say, the young man's right, and they'll get a gun and go off and fight with the Sandinistas or something, so I did me pole angry, because of what I dread, I'd rather you were dead. And then there was this silence, right? And then they all sort of went... And then this woman in a fur coat leant across and she said, I thought you did very well to remember all the words. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to bother with that again.
That's pretty much it. But, you know, laughter is the main thing. And then everything else.
Leave them on a song.
It's quite nice. We can do a song if you like. We do have to wrap up because a van's coming to take me and these chairs back to Harvard. How things have changed. Changed their Square Theatre podcast over the last 6 years. We're not allowed to store the chairs in the theatre, so I've got to take them home.
Oh God!
In the van.
It's so downbeat, isn't it? I mean, I know, but when you do a show and you leave and that, and then 5 minutes after the show ends, it might have been 500, 600, 700 people there, and then they've all gone, and then they come out with an industrial fit. And then you sort of leave, and one of the technicians is undoing something and that, and you just leave, and they go, see you then, mate. And it, like you've delivered a parcel, you know.
I had a tech. This is so rarely happens. I had a tech... at the gig, I came off half time. She went, "That is amazing." I came off the end of this half. She goes, "I'm going to come and see you with my girlfriend and in another." And you just think, that never happens. No tech people ever come and tell you did well.
Yeah,
that's weird, isn't it? That's one. So maybe I'm good now if I've made one backstage person. You wait till you go off with George. He's not going to give us. He won't even say a thing. He likes Maria Bamford. That's the only one he was excited about. But it's so great to have you on, Martin. Thanks so much for coming along. And 36 years of being a stand-up comedian, something like that.
God. Is that a good thing?
I think it is. I think, we were saying backstage, I think that whole thing of, you know, are people either get too big and don't want to stand
fuck
up?
That.
Or they stop. Or they
Who
stop.
Who wants that?
They
Who wants to do a podcast and immediately be on at the Albert Hall?
That, you know, you don't. It's to be out to the to be able to keep playing to seven people from 1982, the same seven, gradually they die off.
Gradually. Better luck in 5 years, I'll do the same joke over and over again. Oh, yes, that's funny.
I think I think for me, stand-up comedy is what the job it actually is. So if you've managed to keep doing that for all those years and are still creating...
What else would it be then, the job of stand-up comedian? Other than stand-up comedy.
Well, but, you know, lots of people become presenters. Or,
oh, right, yeah, yeah.
Or,
yes,
and don't do stand-up.
Yeah.
So I think that's the job. And if you keep doing the job and you keep on creating, which you are, you know, you do, you're writing a column every week, you're coming up with new material all the time. So that's, you know, I think...
Well, the radio thing, strangely, the radio show is, although it's, I have to write, I mean, we record about an hour for each one, but strangely, that doesn't seem so difficult, you know, to write an hour about... Bungy in Suffolk or something or wherever it is, because it's so specific. And then we did Bedford in for example, right? So Bedford, which is perfect for that radio series, because it's everyone's heard of Bedford, but you don't know much about it. No one knows much about it. And then it turns out there's a group there called the Panacea Society, and these people, in all honesty, believed, having studied the matter, that the Garden of Eden is in Bedford. And there's a cult there. And at one point, there were 70 or 80 people living in this big house, believing that the God... And they bought loads of property, and one of the houses has been left empty ever since. It remains empty because it's for Jesus when he comes back. Because last time, they'd never planned it in advance, did they? So this time, that's why all that stuff with a manger... But they've got a house all ready for him in Bedford. And there was this wonderful bit where there was a documentary about them a few years ago on Channel 4. And the oldest member, she now died, so the last one's died out. But the oldest one, she was being interviewed. And in particular, she was being interviewed about the prophet, a woman in the 18th century called Joanna Southcott, that believes they're prophet. And she wrote loads of piles and piles of books, prophecies, including her conversations with the devil. And the woman being interviewed was right. She said, well, I've read them all. And exact words, she said, and I mean, I read her conversations with the devil, and I mean, the devil's so rude. And I thought that was really sweet to be shot. I mean, it's one thing being the Prince of Darkness, but no need to forget your manners, is there? I want your soul. Little word. Want your soul, please. That's better. So I just sort of... I don't know, when you find little things like that about a town, it's just... It's sort of... I know you say it writes itself, but it sort of does.
Yeah. You could also turn up and go, I'm here. Where's my bedroom? Hello, it's me. Jesus, I'm back. Well, this looks nice. I'll live here. I'm going to try that. So, ladies and gentlemen, mass round of applause. Last guest of the series, Mark Neal. We're back in September, biatches. See you in September. Thank you very much. Good. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Mark Steele. Thank you to Pest for doing all the work on playing the music and composing it and stuff for us. That was nice. I mean, it wasn't for us, but we just used it. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for having me for another series. Thank you. We're doing some more in September if you want to come, and October and November. Thank you to everyone at the British Comedy Guide, especially Orange Mark, for putting this out. Thank you to everyone at GoFasterStripe.com, especially Chris Evans, not that one. And thank you to the camera and sound crew down here at Leicester Square Theatre, including Craig, Kinga, George, and all the other people who come along when Craig or George or Kinga can't come. And thank you to, I'm indebted to my producer, Dave Gribb. Thank you. This is a Go Faster. Thank you. This is a Go Faster Stripe, Sky Potato, and Fuzz production. We're off till September. Go to leicestersquaretheatre.com if you want to buy tickets to the upcoming shows. They're already selling, you know, a little bit. And also go to gofasterstripe.com and pick up some emergency questions books to help us carry on making this shit. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoy your summer. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.